I next met with Dr. Lauren Pinter Brown to talk about mantle cell lymphoma and T-cell lymphoma, starting out with a host of questions that were asked by many oncologists in different ways. How do you distinguish indolent from aggressive MCL at diagnosis?
Well, that's what I was trying to discuss a little bit in the talk. I guess proliferative rate would be one thing. Morphology would be another. If the pathologist says it's blastoid, it's not going to be indolent. And then people have discussed these particular clinical presentations, which may be more indolent than not. But honestly, I think it's a problem. Even saying that we have those tools available, I wish there was a better way to do it because we could tailor our therapy so much better.
Do you have any guess what the fraction is of overall patients presenting with mantle cell that fall into this indolent category?
As defined by...
They don't need treatment?
No idea, because the standard of care up until fairly recently was throw the book at them if they're young.
But you always hear about patients, you know, this patient came in, I thought the patient had CLL, I was surprised to find they had mantle cell.
Sure.
Clinically, it looked indolent, and then I just observed the patient.
Well, that's especially the kind of patient with the clinical presentation that's been discussed as indolent is looking like CLL. Not a lot of adenopathy, some blood involvement, maybe a little splenomegaly so that they look like CLL. But I have seen patients that don't look like CLL that look like mantle cell, and they're still indolent. So I am very perplexed by, as are all these practitioners, perplexed by the heterogeneity in mantle cell, and I feel that we don't really have a good handle on it.
So you mentioned proliferation, and I think you talked about this also at the symposium. Is there anything reliable? Can you look at Ki-67, for example?
Well, there is work looking at, in a general sense, that a Ki-67 greater than 30% probably isn't a great thing, that under 10% probably a really good thing. And then you probably have the majority of patients that fall between 10 and 30 and you don't know what to do with them. And that's realizing that Ki-67 is a very subjective evaluation on the pathologist's part.
So that leads into probably at least as common a question, again, posed 10 different ways, but here's one way it came across. 33-year-old man with stage 4 mantle cell bone marrow involvement, symptomatic.
Oh, that's easy.
What is the answer?
Well, some kind of aggressive therapy followed by consolidation with an auto transplant or high-dose therapy with stem cell rescue, if you want to rename it. And I think that the aggressive therapy there needs to involve high-dose ARA-C. Now, whether you do a Nordic regimen, Hyper-CVAD, the GILA, where that was DHAP is the high-dose ARA-C, I'm not sure we know which is right, but I believe that high-dose ARA-C is a very important part of the management.
And is there any patient that I could describe who would be in good condition, you know, on the younger side, where you would think in terms of anything different in terms of induction? In other words, if you were thinking about sending the patient to transplant, instead of being 33, maybe the patient's 65 or whatever, does that automatically mean you'd want to see ARA-C as part of the induction?
Yes, I think so, because if we look at the retrospective NCCN data, it's very clear that with the goal here being progression-free survival, because we know we're not curing the patient, that regimens like Hyper-CVAD give a much better progression-free survival than CHOP. So what's the difference? I mean, Hyper-CVAD has kind of a souped-up CHOP as the A part, but the difference is the ARA-C as the B cycle. And so I really think that if our goal is to increase the patient's progression-free survival, that it needs to be something more than CHOP and specifically should involve ARA-C.
Another question that's kind of related, is BR a reasonable induction regimen prior to transplant for mantle cell?
That's difficult because there's no data. In my mind, I would really distinguish patients for whom I'm willing to give an aggressive approach, including transplantation, as a consolidation option, and those for whom I'm not. And in my mind, if I'm willing to go with the transplantation, and the patient is as well and fit, I'm going to use the ARA-C containing regimen. If I'm not, or the patient is not because they're elderly, have comorbidities, then I would use BR in that sense and come up with some other consolidation or maintenance type strategy. Of course, there's not really a lot of data for that, but that's how I would conceptualize those patients.
I'll throw in another question of my own. Do you think BR is more effective as an induction regimen than R-CHOP?
Well, we have data for that. You know, I think at least they're equivalent. What we don't have information on, because it wasn't part of Rummel's study, was can you collect as well off of BR as CHOP? Maybe you can't. B, having some of the structural constructs as fludarabine, perhaps you can't collect as well. We don't know. So for many of those reasons, because we don't know if patients can collect, we don't know what the long-term toxicities of BR is, and I don't think it's tremendously better than CHOP. Those are the reasons why if I was thinking about an aggressive approach for a patient, I wouldn't use the BR as the induction. I would go all the way and do what we really have data for.
What are your thoughts on combining bortezomib with R-CHOP? There's a lot of interest in oncologists. You know, they see the activity in advanced disease. You probably remember the video we played to one of the docs bringing this up. Where are we in terms of this kind of thinking of, you know, bringing in an upfront?
Well, there's that ECOG trial with the kind of modified hyper-CVAD that has the bortezomib in it. We can also be informed about a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma trial that's ongoing for activated B-cell phenotype that has CHOP with bortezomib in it. So we can see a little bit more about what the toxicity of that might look like. It's a slightly different patient population, but still would allow us to understand how much neuropathy you get a little bit better. But I think at this point, not ready for prime time.
How strongly do you feel about that? I mean, I've seen this done in the community. If a patient comes to you as a second opinion and the first opinion was R-CHOP bortezomib, do you say, that's not what I do, but it's okay? Or, you know, I really don't think you should do this.
I would say, I really don't think you should do this unless there's mitigating circumstances. I'm trying to think what those might be, but because there isn't any data for it. And I believe in using at least the data that we have.
What's the role of rituximab maintenance in mantle cell?
I think undefined at this time. Maybe at Lugano, we'll see the European Mantle Cell Consortium, maybe some preliminary data about rituximab maintenance. But I think clearly that a maintenance or consolidative approach is very important here in mantle cell because we know we can't cure the patients. And in essence, I think we need to increase their progression-free survival until we really have a better idea of what we should do for these patients, whether rituximab is the correct way to go, radioimmunotherapy is the correct way to go, autotransplantation is the correct way to go. I think we don't know the answer, but I would be very unsatisfied just giving, let's say, R-CHOP to a patient or R-bendamustine and leaving it at that, because we know that progression-free survival in those cases is perhaps at best 3 or 4 years, which really isn't that good. So I can say that in my practice, even though I do not have a lot of data to support this, that if a patient was unable or unwilling to go to transplantation, that I would certainly consider some maintenance or consolidative therapy such as radioimmunotherapy or rituximab. But, you know, fully admitting that we don't have data for that at this time.
I thought I heard at the symposium, and I think I've heard this recently in general, that the control arm of the next intergroup study in mantle cell for non-transplant patients will have R maintenance as a control. In other words, everybody will get it randomized to lenalidomide or not.
I think that, of course, is very attractive because it's an active drug, but also remains to be seen toxicity-wise if that's tolerable to patients. But I can't answer the question exactly whether everybody will get R or not.
So here's kind of a related question. 55-year-old status post bone marrow transplant in CR after 2 years of rituximab. Stop or keep going?
Stop.
It's interesting how often oncologists bring up this question of going beyond 2 years. You don't hear that much in the investigators because you're going to say we have no data, right?
Yeah, we have no data, but I think where the oncologists are coming from is the patients because patients, and mine too, get very antsy when you say it's only 2 years. Why can't I have it forever? And many patients will ask that question. And I think maybe as an investigator and trying to be very, very focused on the data always, maybe we're more confident at saying there just isn't any data, I'm not doing it, versus an oncologist who, you know, is trying to be flexible and please the patient and understand where the patient's coming from.
I think it's because the oncologist walks out the door of that patient and goes into the door of five patients with breast cancer where they're getting 5 or 10 years of hormonal therapy and they're kind of thinking, maybe I could be wrong.
Right. No, that might be true. Or maybe the oncologist is worried that they'll walk down the street to the next oncologist and get their rituximab there.
This is kind of related. It caught me off guard a little bit. What about angiogenesis inhibitors in mantle cell?
Well, no information that I'm aware of. Maybe IMIDs are angiogenesis inhibitors in a way.
Well, yeah, that's what I've heard.
Maybe mTOR inhibitors are angiogenesis inhibitors. I'm not really sure.
Here's another one. Are there any new agents targeting cyclin D1 in mantle cell?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, there's an idea for the researchers.
Yeah.
67-year-old with poor performance status who progresses on rituximab bendamustine. What's next?
Probably bortezomib, because it is FDA approved for use in exactly that situation.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about bortezomib and myeloma recently in terms of method and schedule of administration. You know, a lot of people are using weekly IV. Now sub-Q's out. A lot of people are using that. Have those kind of discussions sort of leaked over to mantle cell?
Yes, I think so. I'm not so sure about the subcutaneous administration, but I think that there's probably data in a number of different lymphomas that's acceptable that weekly bortezomib is a reasonable way to administer the drug and certainly so much more convenient for the patient.
86-year-old man in otherwise good health with mantle cell, what kind of treatment up front?
First question is, do they need treatment? Let's assume that the patient's symptomatic in some fashion.
What kind of situations would you be thinking about treatment if the patient were asymptomatic? Bulky disease?
Yeah, and luckily, mantle cell doesn't usually cause bulky disease. I mean, usually when you see a patient with mantle cell, the striking thing is that they have a lot of little nodes, you know, 2 centimeters, 2.5 centimeters or below, and they may have GI involvement, but most patients do not have innumerable big polyps. But my sense is that most patients with mantle cell lymphoma, with the exception perhaps of blastoid mantle cell, do not really have bulky disease. So I think in an 86-year-old, I would be looking at all the clues that I might have as to why I shouldn't treat the patient. You know, not blastoid, maybe low proliferative rate, maybe fitting into one of these clinical scenarios where we hope the patient will have indolent disease, but not trying to dodge the question entirely. If I really had to treat the patient, I might try rituximab alone, see where I get. There's some data for chlorambucil, although that's not a very popular drug in my practice, and probably nobody else's either. I would be extremely concerned about using bendamustine in a very elderly patient, but if I used it, I would dose it way down. I suppose something like Cytoxan, prednisone, and rituximab would also be reasonable.
If you were going to use bendamustine, what dose?
I'm quite a chicken. I sometimes dose as low as 70 milligrams per meter squared for 2 days with rituximab just to get a feel for how the patient's going to do, and then I escalate up the dose.
What do you do in the younger patient in terms of the dose? As I think you remember, we reviewed some data from patterns of care showing there's a lot of heterogeneity in the dose and interval being 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. I tend to use, if I'm using it with rituximab, 90 milligrams per meter squared, 2 consecutive days monthly. My impression has been that like fludarabine, bendamustine can cause prolonged marrow suppression. And I'm sure all of us have had the experience when we used fludarabine a lot of having patients that remain myelosuppressed for very prolonged periods of time, such that you can't deliver any more therapy. So I tend to be a little bit cautious when I'm using it.
Okay, let's go into T-cell lymphomas. And again, I'll just throw out two of a whole bunch of questions that kind of got around the same thing. First one, the experts say CHOP is a poor induction regimen for PTCL, but is there a better one, even considering drugs and regimens and trials? Another way I saw this put, for a newly diagnosed younger patient with PTCL, would you recommend CHOP or a more aggressive regimen?
I think at this time, CHOP's the best we have. I would certainly follow it up in most instances with high-dose therapy with autologous stem cell rescue. There will be a upfront trial looking at CHOP with the addition of etoposide and then alternating with pralatrexate. We'll see if that's any better. You know, what more aggressive regimens do we have? We hear from the people that use our EPOCH most at the National Cancer Institute that that is an ineffective way of treating patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma. We kind of get at that data again from the International T-Cell Project. You know, we have no reason to think that something with high-dose Ara-C in particular might be better. So I think at this moment we're stuck, but we need to incorporate new drugs either into an old backbone or just create an entire new regimen for these patients, and that will take quite some time.
I'm not sure I heard about that trial before. What's exactly you said? There's R-CHOP and etoposide alternating with pralatrexate. What exactly is the regimen?
Well, no R, of course, but CHOOP alternating with pralatrexate like an ABAB with the option to go to transplantation if that's the institution's standard operating procedure.
Interesting. Have you had any patients who received that regimen?
Not yet. The trial hasn't opened yet. It will be done in a T-cell consortium that's in the U.S. There's probably 15 institutions. We all have the registration packet, I believe, but, you know, I haven't had the trial opened at this time, so we'll see.
It's interesting, the idea, though, of sequencing like that. What about combining, you know, bringing in something like pralatrexate or one of the HDAC inhibitors up front?
Well, the difficulty with doing that is that the toxicities of either of those class of agents is thrombopenia. So when we tried to combine pralatrexate, let's say, with even gemcitabine, it became very difficult to deliver the full dose of pralatrexate, which is effective, because of the combined toxicities. So it really represents a huge challenge because we have these good drugs, but they're really difficult to combine with other things. So what we need is the rituximab for T-cell lymphomas, because that might be a nice thing to combine with those agents. But I think that's going to be a difficult obstacle to overcome because, unfortunately, we have drugs with very similar toxicities that we have to work with.
So here's another one that we got 10 variations of: role of auto versus allo transplant in PTCL, and then 30-year-old man, PTCL and NOS, received CHOP, then had a CR followed by stem cell transplant 1 year ago and just relapse, ? Pralatrexate, ? Then allo transplant.
Okay, so there's two questions, I guess. One is auto versus allo, and that's very much dependent on which institution you talk to. I would say if I wanted to generalize between all the investigators, you know, that I talk to, there's some investigators that don't use any kind of transplantation. And then probably middle of the road approach would be auto transplantation for patients unless they're very low risk, which is almost nobody, with the use of allotransplantation for particularly bad histologies. So the particularly bad histologies would include things like intrahepatic T-cell lymphoma, gamma-delta T-cell lymphoma, where people wouldn't even bother with the autotransplant. Adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma would be another example where nobody would bother with the autotransplant. And then the second question relates to a patient that's had an autotransplant, relapse after a year. I guess it's a part A and part B. Do you go to the allo transplant? I'd say absolutely if there's a good donor. And the A or the B part, depending on how you phrase the question, is what do you use to get that patient to the point of allo transplantation? And I'm sure you get many different answers. Some people would say standard salvage, ICE, DHAP. Certainly pralatrexate has been used as a bridge to transplantation. There were 6 such patients in the original trial that utilize that trial as a bridge to different kinds of transplants, so that's not crazy. I think perhaps sometimes we delude ourselves in thinking that these salvage therapies that are more aggressive have a higher response rate in this setting, but I'm not sure they really do. Pralatrexate's 30%. I'm not sure DHAP or ICE is any higher than 30%. You know, I don't really know the data, but because there is none, but I have a sneaking suspicion that it's not a whole lot better.
Here's another one. I have a patient for whom CHOP and ICE failed. I like the way he or she phrased that. And is now on pralatrexate with good response. What's the regimen of choice should that fail? If I get him to CR and the disease recurs, can I use pralatrexate again?
Okay, if that fails, you don't have an FDA-approved drug for peripheral T-cell lymphoma, but there is data presented on romidepsin in the same kind of setting. So I think different kind of mechanism of action would be a very reasonable choice. The question of getting the CR and stopping pralatrexate, that was really problematic when the trial was done. There are people actually that have been on pralatrexate for over 2 years and tolerate that just fine. So the question really is, should you stop the drug or, you know, just continue it along if it isn't bothering the patient that much, knowing that it's very hard to get somebody with peripheral T-cell lymphoma back into a response once you lose it, and they tend to be very aggressive diseases. I don't know the answer to that, but I think in my own practice, if it wasn't bothering the patient And particularly if the patient had very bad disease, as I assume this patient who's failed two regimens has, I would encourage the patient to stay on until progression or toxicity.
So a couple questions about CTCL. When I saw your slides, I just loved them. I mean, they were so simple, appearing, condensed down, and I really liked the way you kind of describe your own algorithm. Here's the question. How would you treat and sequence treatment in CTCL, and how do you approach follow-up?
Well, one of my panel members at the talk said something that I actually don't agree with very much, and that is get to know one thing and keep doing it. The reason I don't agree with that is that many of us that do this a lot see that there are different presentations of patients, and patients do have different needs with respect to why they're getting therapy. And I think we have to realize that even though all these therapies have about a 30% response rate, that's where the similarities sometimes stop. They have different onsets of action, they have different toxicities, some of them work better in different subsets of patients. So if you ask me a simple question of sequencing, I can't give it to you because, for instance, let's look at a patient who has tumor stage mycosis fungoides versus, you know, a lot of blood involvement or Sézary syndrome. I might approach those patients very differently. And I would have a different algorithm. So I guess my simple slides are good, but I need to have the more in-depth algorithm of how would I approach a patient with one tumor versus a lot of tumors? How would I approach transform mycosis fungoides? How would I approach Sézary syndrome or erythrodermic MF? I think there's different answers for those different groups of patients.
I thought you were going to make it easier. How about just picking out two or three of those and give us, you know, your usual preferred treatment?
Right. So let's talk about the majority of patients that an oncologist is going to see in a community practice are really going to be early stage patients, patches or plaques. So I know this goes against the grain of our oncologic training, but I would be treating them with topical therapies, either nitrogen mustard, if we can get it, or light therapy. And I know that's very foreign to the oncologist, and other than topical nitrogen mustard isn't something the oncologist is going to be able to do in their own practice. So they're going to have to work with a dermatologist most likely. But really, those patients shouldn't be treated with systemic agents up front. And I see a lot of oncologists doing that. Now let's go to the minority of patients. Let's look at somebody that has tumors. So if one tumor, no problem, that can be radiated and we can approach the rest of the patient's skin disease, as I just mentioned, for stage one. Lots of tumors, the kinds of things that tend to work well for those patients are bexarotene, romidepsin would probably work, denileukin diftatox would work. Things that won't work very well, interferon, photopheresis, things that revolve around the patient's immune system being part of the treatment, don't work very well in bulk disease. So tumor will count as bulk. Patients that have Sézary syndrome do have the opportunity, if they don't have a lot of bulk of disease, of getting things like photopheresis, interferon, bexarotene, HDAC inhibitors, pralatrexate. So that's a little bit how I would look at this. And transform mycosis fungoides, actually, if it's transformed in node or viscera or lots of skin sites, is more akin to peripheral T-cell lymphoma approach, if I want to try and simplify this a little bit.
Yeah, you know, your thought there about the other panel member's comment, which is just a few days ago, and I can barely remember who said it, but I do remember hearing it. And I was thinking that, you know, kind of that was sort of the old way we did things, and now we're supposedly doing personalized oncology. But in terms of this disease, you have these clinical factors that you consider. Are there any tissue biomarkers that are even possibilities to predict which one of these agents might be helpful? Don't say no.
No, there really isn't. I thought you were going to say, are there tissue biomarkers to tell who might be a bad actor? That there is, CD30. You know, if you have CD30, it kind of goes along with transformation, so that there is. But no real good biomarkers that I can think of in terms of which treatment should you select.
When I hear CD30, I think brentuximab vedotin.
There is a lot of interest in using BV-DOTIN for mycosis fungoides, and there will be a trial that looks at that.
So we heard about BV-DOTIN in anaplastic large cell and Hodgkin. Are you saying there's evidence of CD30 and maybe the possibility of this being helpful in cutaneous T-cell?
Yeah, many of us participated in a trial with SGN30, and we were very struck by the fact that it worked extremely well in CD30 positive diseases of the skin. So that is transformycosis fungoides, anaplastic large cell lymphomatoid papulosis. Many of us still have patients that are in complete remission and their therapy was 5 years ago. But another observation that was made was that many of these patients had mycosis fungoides lesions in addition to these other lesions that we were treated, and they too went away. So there's a lot of interest. We don't have the naked antibody, you know, it's not going to be available. So there's a lot of interest in using this newer agent in that setting to see what the activity really is, because the toxicity is so reasonable. So there will be a trial looking at that going forward. And I would imagine, giving the data for the naked antibody, that it will be a very successful and productive trial.
So I wasn't totally clear in terms of the naked antibody in Hodgkin and anaplastic. I think it was anaplastic that there was some activity. But what about the naked antibody in CTCL or mycosis fungoides?
Well, the trial actually only looked at CD30 positive skin lymphomas. So if the patient had mycosis fungoides and it wasn't CD30 positive, they weren't eligible for that trial. So we're only relying on the investigator's observations that many of the other lesions, even though they weren't being evaluated for purposes of trial, also went away. So there may be enough CD30 on those skin lesions to still attract the drug and allow the drug's activity. And that's really what the point of this next trial will be.
Fascinating. So one final question is a case, actually. Young woman with Sézary syndrome with massive adenopathy, symptomatic skin involvement, who has failed topical therapy or topical therapy failed her. Topical therapy, denolucan, diftatox, and HDAC inhibitors. What are your treatment recommendations?
Okay, first recommendation is when somebody has Sézary syndrome, we don't give topical therapies as the only therapy. So of course, you know, it failed her or she failed it, because this is a systemic disease. So you're not approaching the bulk of the disease, which is really skin and nodes. Next comment would be, very rarely do we get bulky adenopathy and Sézary syndrome by my definition of bulk, which would be at least 5 centimeters. My question would be, has the patient transformed? Do we need to biopsy those nodes? Because as I mentioned before, transform mycosis fungoides, I start to think about it differently. But let's assume that the patient really just has Sézary syndrome. How do I pick therapies? If it's really bulky, as I had mentioned before, things like a photopheresis by themselves, interferon by themselves, it just won't be effective. So I would be thinking more along the lines of romidepsin would be an excellent choice. Denileukin diftatox would be a good choice as well.
She already had that.
Oh, okay, fine. The reason I was choosing romidepsin is because there's some data that shows us that we can get blood responses as well. That was reported in that data set. Pralatrexate might be a choice, though we only have, you know, phase 1-2 data in a small data set, and it's not FDA approved for that reason. Other things that might be choices are single agent chemotherapy, gemcitabine's a choice, Doxil's a great choice, methotrexate's a choice. So that's kind of how I would be thinking about it.
So final question is, are there any questions that you have received from oncologists in both of these diseases, T-cell as well as mantle cell, that you think are good questions that we haven't talked about?
I think the one thing that we haven't talked about is, what is the role of transplantation in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma? Something to think about, because you had just mentioned a young woman with Sézary syndrome, and there is a role for allotransplantation in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. Autotransplantation, I think, not so much of a role. There is a paper looking at that. What it shows is that you can get the disease to go away, but the patients relapse fairly quickly within the first couple of years. There was a comment made that maybe their relapse isn't as bad as the initial presentation, but I would say maybe not worth it to most patients. But allotransplantation actually has offered people very long-term disease-free survival and perhaps cure, because I think that many of the patients are out long enough to say that they're probably cured. And in a young patient, I think it's certainly something we need to think about, particularly if someone has very difficult to control disease or has had the disease so long and they've gone through all the treatment that we currently have and you're running up against a wall and there will be no more treatment. I think it's something to really consider and probably isn't considered enough because, you know, not very well publicized, if you will.